32.
It's pretty obvious which warehouse we are looking for here. Fourth one on the left. The road that runs down toward the waterfront is blocked off by several shipping containers. The big steel boxes you see on backs of 18-wheelers. They are arranged in a herringbone pattern, so that in order to get past them, you have to slalom back and forth half a dozen times, passing through a narrow, maze-like channel between high walls of steel. Guys with guns are perched on top, looking down at YT, as she guides her plank through the obstacle course. By the time she makes it out into the clear, she's been heavily checked out. There is the occasional light bulb on a wire strung around, and even a couple of strings of Christmas tree lights. These are switched on just to make her feel a little more welcome. She can't see anything, just lights making colored halos amid a generalized cloud of dust and fog. In front of her, access to the waterfront is blocked off by another maze of shipping containers. One of them has a graffiti sign. The UKOD says, "Try some countdown today." "What's the UKOD?" she says, just to break the ice a little. "Undisputed king of the ozone destroyers," says a man's voice. He is just in the act of jumping down from the loading dock of the warehouse to her left. Back inside the warehouse, YT can see electric lights and glowing cigarettes. "That's what we call Emilio." "Oh, right," YT says. "The Freon guy. I'm not here for chill." "Well," says the guy, a tall, rangy dude in his 40s, much too skinny to be 40 years old. He yanks the butt of a cigarette from his mouth and throws it away like a dart. "What'll it be, then?" "What does Snow Crash cost?"
1.75 gippas," the guy says.
"I thought it was 1.5, YT says.
The guy shakes his head.
"Inflation, you know.
Still, it's a bargain. Hell, that plank you're on is probably worth 100 gippas.
"You can't even buy these for dollars," YT says, getting her back up.
"Look, all I've got is $1.5 quadrillion.
She pulls the bundle out of her pocket. The guy laughs, shakes his head, hollers back to his colleagues inside the warehouse.
"You guys, we got a chick here who wants to pay in Mises."
"Better get rid of him fast, honey," says a sharper, nastier voice, "or get yourself a wheelbarrow."
It's an even older guy with a bald head, curly hair on the sides, and a paunch. He's standing up on the loading dock.
"If you're not going to take it, just say so," YT says.
"All of this chatter has nothing to do with business."
"We don't get chicks back here very often," the fat, bald old guy says.
YT knows that this must be the UKOD himself.
"So we'll give you a discount for being spunky. Turn around."
"Fuck you," YT says. She's not going to turn around for this guy. Everyone within earshot laughs.
"Okay. Do it," the UKOD says.
The tall, skinny guy goes back over to the loading dock and hauls an aluminum briefcase down, sets it on top of a steel drum in the middle of the road, so that it's about waist height.
"Pay first," he says.
She hands him the Mises. He examines the bundle, sneers, throws it back into the warehouse with a sudden backhand motion. All the guys inside laugh some more. He opens up the briefcase, revealing the little computer keyboard. He shoves his ID card into the slot, types in it for a couple of seconds. He unsnaps a tube from the top of the briefcase, places it into the socket in the bottom part. The machine draws it inside, does something, spits it back out. He hands the tube to YT. The red numbers on top are counting down from 10.
"When it gets down to 1, hold it up to your nose and start inhaling," the guy says.
She's already backing away from him.
"You got a problem, little girl?" he says.
"Not yet," she says. Then she throws the tube up in the air as hard as she can. The chop of the rotor blades comes out of nowhere. The whirlwind reaper blurs over their heads. Everyone crouches for an instant as surprise buckles their knees. The tube does not come back to Earth.
"You fucking bitch," the skinny guy says.
"That was a really cool plan," the UKOD says. "But the part I can't figure out is, why would a nice, smart girl like you participate in a suicide mission?" The sun comes out. About half a dozen suns, actually. All around them, up in the air, so that there are no shadows. The faces of the skinny man and the UKOD look flat and featureless under this blinding illumination. Whitey is the only person who can see worth a damn because her night visions have compensated for it. The men wince and sag beneath the light. Whitey turns to look behind herself. One of the miniature suns is hanging above the maze of shipping containers, casting light into all its crannies, blinding the gunmen who stand guard there. The scene flashes too light and too dark as her goggles electronics try to make up their mind. But in the midst of this whole visual tangle, she gets one image printed indelibly on her retina. The gunmen going down like a tree line in a hurricane, and for just an instant, a line of dark angular things silhouetted above the maze as they crested like a cybernetic tsunami. Rat things. They have evaded the whole maze by leaping over it in long, flat parabolas. Along the way, some of them have slammed right through the bodies of men holding guns, like NFL fullbacks plowing full speed through nerdy sideline photographers. Then, as they land on the road in front of the maze, there is an instant burst of dust with frantic white sparks dancing around to the bottom. And while all this is happening, YT doesn't hear. She feels one of the rat things impacting on the body of the tall, skinny guy. Hears his ribs crackling like a ball of cellophane. Hell is already breaking loose inside the warehouse, but her eyes are trying to follow the action, watching the sparks and dust contrails of more rat things drawing themselves down the length of the road in an instant and then going airborne to the top of the next barrier. 3 seconds have passed since she threw the tube into the air. She is turning back to look inside the warehouse, but someone's on top of the warehouse catching her eye for a second. It's another gunman, a sniper, stepping out from behind an air conditioning unit, just getting used to the light, raising his weapon to his shoulder. YT winces as a red laser beam from his rifle sweeps across her eyes once, twice, as he zeroes his sights on her forehead. Behind him, she sees the Whirlwind Reaper, its rotors making a disc under the brilliant light, a disc that is foreshortened into a narrow ellipse, and then into a steady silver line. Then it flies right past the sniper. The chopper pulls up into a hard turn, searching for additional prey, and something falls beneath it in a powerless trajectory. She thinks that it has dropped a bomb. But it's the head of the sniper spinning rapidly, throwing out a fine pink helix under the light. The little chopper's rotor blade must have caught him in the nape of the neck. One part of her is dispassionately watching the head bounce and spin in the dust, and the other part of her is screaming her lungs out. She hears a crack, the first loud noise so far. She turns to follow the sound, looking in the direction of a water tower that looms above this area, providing a fine vantage point for a sniper. But then her attention is drawn by the pencil-thin blue-white exhaust of a tiny rocket that lances up into the sky from Ing's van. It doesn't do anything. It just goes up to a certain height and hovers, sitting on its exhaust. She doesn't care. She's kicking her way down the road now in her plank, trying to get something between her and that water tower. There is a second cracking noise. Before the sound even reaches her ears, the rocket darts horizontally like a minnow, makes one or two minor cuts to correct its course, zeroes in on that sniper's perch, up in the water tower's access ladder. There is a great, nasty explosion without any flame or light, like the loud, pointless booms that you get sometimes at fireworks shows. For a moment, she can hear the clamor of shrapnel ringing through the ironwork of the water tower. Just before she kicks her way back into the maze, a dust line whips past her, snapping rocks and fragments of broken glass into her face. It shoots into the maze. She hears it ping-pong all the way through, kicking off the steel walls in order to change direction. It's a rat thing clearing the way for her. How sweet! Smooth move, X-Lax, she says, climbing back into Ing's van.
Her throat feels thick and swollen. Maybe it's from screaming. Maybe it's the toxic waste. Maybe she's getting ready to gag.
"Didn't you know about the snipers?" she says. If she can keep talking about the details of the job, maybe she can keep her mind off what the Whirlwind Reaper did.
"I didn't know about the one on the water tower," Ing says. "But as soon as he fired a couple of rounds, we plotted the bullet's trajectories on millimeter wave and backtraced them."
He talks to his van, and it pulls out of its hiding place, headed for I-405.
Seems like kind of an obvious place to look for a sniper. "He was in an unfortified position, exposed from all sides," Ing says. "He chose to work from a suicidal position, which is not a typical behavior for drug dealers. Typically, they are more pragmatic. Now, do you have any other criticisms of my performance?"
"Well, did it work?"
"Yes. The tube was inserted into a sealed chamber inside the helicopter before it discharged its contents. It was then flash-frozen in liquid helium before it could chemically self-destruct. We now have a sample of Snow Crash, something that no one else has been able to get. It is the kind of success on which reputations such as mine are constructed. How about the rat things? How about them?"
"Are they back in the van now?
Back there?"
Whitey jerks her head aft. Ing pauses for a moment. Whitey reminds herself that he is sitting in his office in Vietnam in 1955, watching all of this on TV.
"Three of them are back," Ing says. "Three are on their way back. And three of them I left behind to carry out additional pacification measures."
"You're leaving them behind?"
"They'll catch up," Ing says. "On a straightaway, they can run at 700 miles per hour.
Is it true they have nuke stuff inside of them?"
"Radiothermal isotopes.
What happens if one gets busted open? Everyone gets all mutated?"
"If you ever find yourself in the presence of a destructive force powerful enough to decapsulate those isotopes," Ing says, "radiation sickness will be the least of your worries."
"Will they be able to find their way back to us?"
"Didn't you ever watch Lassie Come Home when you were a child?" he asks. "Or rather, more of a child than you are now?"
"So, she was right. The rat things are made from dog parts."
"That's cruel," she says. "This brand of sentimentalism is very predictable," Ing says. "To take a dog out of his body, keep him in a hutch all the time. When the rat thing, as you call it, is in his hutch, do you know what he's doing?
Licking his electric nuts.
Chasing frisbees through the surf. Forever. Eating steaks that grow on trees. Lying beside the fire in a hunting lodge. I haven't installed any testicle-licking simulations yet, but now that you have brought it up, I shall consider it.
What about when he's out of the hutch, running around doing errands for you?
Can't you imagine how liberating it is for a pit bull terrier to be capable of running 700 miles an hour?"
Whitey doesn't answer. She is too busy trying to get her mind around this concept.
"Your mistake," Ing says, "is that you think that all mechanically assisted organisms, like me, are pathetic cripples. In fact, we are better than we were before. Where do you get the pit bulls from? An incredible number of them are abandoned every day, in cities all over the place. You cut up pound puppies? We save abandoned dogs from certain extinction and send them to what amounts to dog heaven.
My friend Roadkill and I had a pit bull, Fido. We found it in an alley. Some asshole had shot it in the leg. We had a vet fix it up. We kept it in this empty apartment in Roadkill's building for a few months, played with it every day, brought it food. And then one day we came to play with Fido, and he was gone. Someone broke in and took him away. Probably sold him to a research lab."
"Probably," Ing says. "But that's no way to keep a dog."
"It's better than the way he was living before." There's a break in the conversation as Ing occupies himself with talking to his van, maneuvering onto the Long Beach freeway, headed back into town.
"Do they remember stuff?" Whitey says.
"To the extent dogs can remember anything," Ing says. "We don't have any way of erasing memories."
"So maybe Fido is a rat thing somewhere right now."
"I would hope so, for his sake," Ing says.
In a Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong franchise in Phoenix, Arizona, Ing Security Industries' semi-autonomous guard unit B-782 comes awake. The factory that put him together thinks of him as a robot named number B-782, but he thinks of himself as a pit bull terrier named Fido. In the old days, Fido was a bad little doggy sometimes. But now, Fido lives in a nice little house in a nice little yard. Now he has become a nice little doggy. He likes to lie in his house and listen to the other nice doggies bark. Fido is part of a big pack. Tonight there is a lot of barking from a place far away. When he listens to this barking, Fido knows that a whole pack of nice doggies is very excited about something. A lot of very bad men are trying to hurt a nice girl. This has made the doggies very angry and excited. In order to protect the nice girl, they are hurting some of the bad men, which is as it should be. Fido does not come out of his house. When he first heard the barking, he became excited. He likes nice girls, and it makes him especially upset when bad men try to hurt them. Once there was a nice girl who loved him. That was before, when he lived in a scary place, and he was always hungry, and many people were bad to him. But the nice girl loved him and was good to him. Fido loves the nice girl very much, but he can tell from the barking of the other doggies that the nice girl is safe now. So he goes back to sleep.